It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be in tomorrow. Coming up, a UW researcher is trying to fight disease in Africa with flip-flops. We'll find out how a humble sandal can save lives. First, we continue this week's look back at the top stories in Wisconsin with a look at the booming sand extraction industry. The sand is mined here in Wisconsin and sent out of the state to be used in hydraulic fracturing of natural gas and oil. That's better known as fracking. WPR reporter Rich Kramer is our man on the frack sand, and he joins us now to look at how the industry grew over the year and the controversies it raised. Rich, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob.
So first of all, did we see big growth in the industry over the course of 2013?
I would say we did. The last numbers that I had, and this was towards the beginning of 2013, was that there were about 160-some-odd operations. That's, mines processing facilities where they wash the sand, and also the rail loadout where they get it on the rail cars and send it off to Texas and Pennsylvania and North Dakota, where have you. But now it looks like that number has jumped to 224, but that doesn't mean that there are 224 sand mines actually digging. What the DNR says is that there's 61 mines, 43 processing centers, and 28 shipping operations actually operational. But there are another 57 proposed developing mines across the state, 28 processing operations and shipping operations. So total permits that are out there, total possibility is 224, and that's a big jump.
And it sounds like with a lot of those permits in the works, actual extraction could go up more in 2014.
It could. It all depends on, supply and demand. It depends on what the prices are for natural gas. That's been pretty low. But what I think we'll see in 2014 is a lot of these mines that and planned operations, they'll start to open up and start getting more product out.
Well, that growth in the sand mining has led to a growth in reaction from local citizens and local governments. What kind of things have we seen on the local level in the neighborhood of these frack sand operations?
Well, as far as citizens, they've been concerned from day one. Way back in 2008, we started hearing people worried about the noise. They started worrying about the dust, which can cause some troubles if you breathe it in. So if you get high concentrations of the silica dust in your lungs. But local governments have really kind of clamped down a little bit. It started, in 2011, 2012 with some towns using police powers to create ordinances that would regulate these companies. But it ramped up big time this year with we had the towns of Pepin and Stockholm along the Great River Road, kind of in the Mississippi Lake Pepin area, they passed a 10-mile zone where no frack sand mining was allowed. They didn't officially ban it because they'd probably get sued instantly, but they banned any operation, any facility, any company that had more than 50 truck trips per day coming in and out of the facility. And sand mining usually requires hundreds of truck trips. Trempealeau County passed a one-year moratorium, and they also changed their permits to kind of clamp down on people, their permit process on people that would get a permit and then kind of sit on it and not do anything with that. If they sit longer than 12 months, they lose it. So there has been, there are other examples, obviously, but there has been some crackdown.
And then companies have responded to this at the local level. We'll get to the state level in a minute, but they've tried, I gather, to get some towns to annex land from the county to exempt themselves from those regulations. Is that right?
That's right. You're in the right direction, in the right ballpark. It's actually they're annexing from towns to cities, but the annexation basically, if a frack sand company has any part of its property that actually touches a city limit, they can petition the city to annex their land. And if they annex their land, then the frack sand company, which may already have an agreement with the town that they're located in, they have kind of a clean slate, and they can work with the city to get regulations that are more favorable for them. The big sticking point so far, and there have been a number of annexations. In 2012, there were a couple. This year, there were at least three that I know of and one pending. But hours of operation seem to be a big sticking point. They want to run 24/7 and get as much product out as they can. And a lot of towns in Trempealeau County, itself, which is zoned countywide, they've been reluctant to do that. They've only let them operate 12 or 16 hours.
And then at the state level, there's some legislation afoot that would render a lot of that local, a lot of those local ordinances moot. Is that right?
Yeah, that there's going to be some more kicks at the cat. But what was introduced is something called Senate Bill 349, SB 349. The official title is the Regulatory Certainty Act. And that was introduced by Republican State Senator Tom Tiffany and Republican State Representative Joan Ballweg. And their aim, their claimed goal is to kind of create some more uniformity as far as regulations so that you don't have one town being, you know, having one set of regulations, then the town right next door could have a totally different set of regulations. They argued that this was, you know, kind of ridiculous for the industry and was a burden. So they said to fix that, the state will just take over and they will, the towns won't be able to regulate anything really as far as frac sand mining is concerned. And that has been very controversial.
And that is not a done deal. Where does that sit right now?
It's still in committee. I don't know the name of the committee offhand, but it was introduced to committee and then it has to pass that. There's going to be a lot more changes. Tom Tiffany told me that he's working with towns. He's working with the Towns Association, the Counties Association, frac sand companies. He's getting everyone together to try to craft something that it maintains the intent of the legislation to create uniformity, but also leaves the local control intact as possible, which is very, very important for local governments.
And while all this is going on, the DNR has been keeping an eye on the industry. What has gone on in 2013 from the DNR point of view?
Well, first off, the DNR got a couple extra helpers to keep an eye on air permits. The frac sand companies get air permits. They, you know, they discharge basically soot. They've got these large heaters that dry the frac sand, but also the air permits deal with just total dust that is present. If stuff gets too dusty, and we're talking dust the size of particulate matter 10 or 10 microns, big chunks of dust. If it's way too dusty, they can come down and issue a notice of violation. So they got two additional staff members. They asked the governor for that, and he obliged. It was some at a cost of around $200,000, but the DNR also had big news recently. This spring, a really heavy rainstorm. DNR threw out six violations because of a stormwater runoff. And, of course, the big news was the Department of Justice announced that a judge had basically, for lack of a better term, fined one company $200,000 for stormwater discharges in Trempealeau County. There's another company that was accused of violating air permits, and they had to pay $80,000 to the state.
And then looking ahead at 2014, as we wrap up, do you see more enforcement action like this being pretty likely?
Well, we'll see. These companies, they don't, even though $200,000 might not seem like a lot for a company that makes millions and millions of dollars, or tens or hundreds of millions perhaps, but they still don't want to be paying these fines. So they're continually trying to tweak their mines and their processing centers so they can contain that stormwater. I think we'll see less operations getting fines. A lot of the violations have to do with companies just building too quickly or you know, doing something before they get a permit. And I think that that's going to kind of slow down.
Rich, thanks a lot and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Thanks, Rob.
That's WPR reporter Rich Kramer joining us from our Eau Claire studio. Coming up, a Wisconsin health researcher is trying to fight disease with flip-flops. He joins the show after a look at the headlines with Kristen Durst. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A Wisconsin research effort aims to fight a disease in Africa not with antibiotics or high-tech surgical devices, but with flip-flops. Tony Goldberg is in the studio. He's a professor of epidemiology at UW-Madison, and he's the associate director for research at UW-Madison's Global Health Institute. Tony, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
Before we get to the flip-flops, do you see a trend toward trying to find inexpensive kind of lifestyle solutions to health problems around the world?
Absolutely. I think it may be a coming wave. You know, we've had a lot of technological development in health and medicine over the last century. And now in a lot of places, our biggest impediment is trying to get the technology that already exists to be adopted well by the communities that need it. So that's a huge challenge, every bit as large as developing the technologies in the first place.
Well, tell us about the disease you're trying to fight and the people who suffer from it.
So the disease we're targeting is in general called soil-transmitted helminths. And most people will be aware of hookworm as a great example of that. There's a number of helminths or worms that have stages that live in the soil and can get into your body either through burrowing through your feet or if you accidentally ingest soil. This is a worldwide disease, most common in the tropics. We do have it here in the U.S., and it's been historically and recently a big problem all across the world.
And you're working in Uganda in particular, is that right?
That's correct. My team's working in Uganda, and I've been working there for over 20 years running a long-term research project, so we're familiar with the communities in that area. Although this the idea we're testing and the disease we're looking at are not only in that area of the world.
Mm-hmm. So the HoloFlip or HoloFlip, how do you say it?
We've come up with the name HoloFlop.
Flop, okay. So tell us about it. What is it and why are you hopeful that it might make a difference?
Well, the way to prevent soil-transmitted helminths is pretty simple. You simply block them from getting into your feet. And a tried-and-true technology for doing that is the simple flip-flop-style sandal. That's been known for a long time. So the solution is there. The problem is how do you get people to wear these flip-flops in the right place at the right time and to understand why they should do it? So our innovation is to actually put a message telling people how they should wear flip-flops and why they should wear flip-flops on the flip-flop itself. And the way we're going to do that is by creating a very interesting image that depicts the benefits of wearing those flip-flops that we stick on the shoes.
So, and the people in the area you're working in, flip-flops are a common footwear. This is not a new invention for them, but they don't necessarily wear them when they need them, right?
That's right. Flip-flops and similar shoes are really common all throughout sub-Saharan Africa, but they're also not accessible financially for a lot of people. So one problem is that people may have a perfectly good pair of shoes, but they're not willing to wear them in the places that are kind of dirty where they might be infected. They save them for special occasions, maybe like church or other places like that.
Right. So I can only afford one pair of these things. I don't want to wear them where they're going to get messed up. And the place they're going to get messed up is the most likely place to catch this disease.
That's exactly right. So our solution to that is we're going to try to create an educational technology that's going to at least give people the information to understand the situations under which flip-flop wearing would be most beneficial.
So an obvious question would be, why not just a printed label, a text label on this?
Well, a couple of reasons. These have to be on shoes, so that we have to pack a lot of information into a very small space. And it just turns out there are some image technologies available these days that have gotten to the point where you can create almost a proto-animation effect on a printed image. We call our shoe the HoloFlop. It's not actually a hologram. The thing we're creating is called a lenticular image. And you may remember these from greeting cards or advertisements where it's an image where you look at it one way, it looks like one thing, then you turn it a little bit at an angle and it flips to something else. Mm-hmm. These have come a long way. They're printed on a special type of paper with lenses in a line that are on different planes. So that creates the flip or animation effect. We're going to see if we can pack a whole lot of information to depict the benefits of wearing these shoes in one of these images that can be put on the shoe itself.
So you've got an idea like this. You've got the product, the HoloFlop. How do you put it into practice and make sure it works?
Well, that's the focus of our project. We're funded by the Gates Foundation, who's all about new technologies or getting technologies accepted across the world. And our plan is to actually trial test this in Uganda. So we're developing the shoe itself. We're developing the image. We're working with some graphic designers. We're working with some shoe companies. And our idea is to distribute this new technology and to do two things. First of all, to measure scientifically whether or not it changes people's risk of acquiring these soil-transmitted helminths, as we predict it should. But on top of that, I'm working with my postdoctoral researcher, Sarah Page, who's an expert in public health and medical geography. And she's going to be leading a component of the study that's going to look at why people do or do not accept this technology and how well they understand the image. So our idea here is that it's not enough to simply create a new technology. Really, if you're going to create it and deploy it, you want to understand why it works as well as if it works.
That's one of the most fascinating things to me about medicine and public health. Even though you have a solution, whether it's flip-flops or it's a medication or a procedure or a test, you have to be anthropologists, cultural anthropologists, too, to make sure that it somehow fits into the local culture and the local lifestyle.
Well, I think that's a very astute observation, and I'm proud to say that my PhD is actually in anthropology, of all
really?
Things. It is, yeah. So I think this particular case of the holoflop is a special case of a general phenomenon, which is the acceptance or non-acceptance of new medical technologies. And we see this all over the place. We see it in the United States with, for example, vaccines. You know, there are vaccines out there that are very effective for preventing certain infectious diseases, and yet there are people who elect not to use them, even though the risks of adverse effects to the vaccines are far smaller than the risks of getting the disease that the vaccines are designed to prevent. Why is that? That's not really a question for people working in labs on developing new vaccines. It's more of a question for anthropologists, sociologists, political scientists. And I think if we can understand that, that's every bit as important as understanding the technological barriers to healthcare.
Have we had a lot of flops? Sorry, not the flip-flop kind, but in the sense of failure when it comes to medical technologies. We've got this great idea, and maybe we even ship it to Area X, whatever that might be, but nobody did that work, that groundwork first to make sure how it fits in?
There's a long list of examples of that, failed medical technology deployment. One that comes to mind off the top of my head are bed nets for malaria. Now, sleeping under a net is a great way to prevent a mosquito from biting you in the middle of the night and transmitting malaria. And a lot of people have had the idea, well, let's just get a whole bunch of bed nets mm-hmm. and throw them out there in some community that's having a malaria problem. And that sounds like a great idea, but what happens in some cases is that people will use the bed nets for other things. For example, for fishing as a fishing net, or for, you know, they might sell it because, of course, and they have to weigh the economic benefits of selling the net versus preventing a disease that they may not be able to prevent anyway. Often, from a public health perspective, the best use of things like bed nets would be to protect mothers and their infants. And yet, in some places in the world, you know, other people in the household sort of have priority and might use the net. So,
like maybe the person who is the breadwinner for the household.
That's exactly right.
And you've got to keep them healthy or nobody eats or something like
that's
that.
That's exactly right. So a lot of these great technologies that sound terrific on paper don't pan out exactly as you would predict. It kind of spirals, and you see this time and time again. So I think by coupling these deployments of these new technologies with these kind of piggyback studies of social acceptance, that really increases your bang for the buck.
And you've got this support from the Gates Foundation. Is this reflective of an understanding of what you're talking about here, of the need to match the technology to the culture?
I hope so. We were funded through the Gates Foundation by their Grand Challenges Explorations Program, which is all about the development and deployment of novel medical technologies. I hope that our award and some others that have also been awarded do indicate an appreciation of this need to study social acceptance along with the technologies themselves.
And you're down in the dirt, literally, on this project, but are you preaching the gospel here to other people in the public health community that we need to make these connections?
I think for some people I am preaching the gospel, mm-hmm. and that's not always a bad thing to do. But mm-hmm. I think there are other sectors of the healthcare community that need this idea reinforced. You know, there's a lot of money being spent on developments of new technologies, new drugs, new vaccines, new information technologies, and it's not always clear that people are giving the same amount of attention to the impediments to deploying those technologies.
In our last 30 seconds or so, as you move forward, what does success look like with this flip-flop program?
I think success would be twofold. It would be a demonstration that the technology works to reduce helminth infection. But also, I think it would be a recognition that it works the way we think it's going to work, that the image we design will convey to people the benefits of wearing these shoes under the right circumstances, and it will be a socially accepted thing that may grow to have a life of its own.
Tony, thanks a lot for joining us on the show.
You're very welcome.
That's Tony Goldberg. He's professor of epidemiology at UW-Madison, also associate director for research at UW-Madison's Global Health Institute. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, Veronica Rickert will be back for a New Year's Day edition of the show. She'll look ahead to the top stories to watch in 2014 in Wisconsin and around the nation. We'll have some advice for quitting smoking. Our guest has one of the best strategies to quit every single week until it sticks. And we'll find out about the best movies of 2013. You can weigh in with some of your nominations. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, there's been a lot of talk about the idea of technology making us less smart. But our guest says when we combine our brain power with the knowledge stored online, we can be smarter than ever. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for spending your New Year's Eve with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later in the program, we'll find out why Democrats are presiding over the nation's major cities and what it means for the future of American national politics. First, we spoke with Wired Magazine's Clive Thompson a few months back about the relationship between technology and our brains. As more and more of us rely on technology and the internet to get us through the day, some are worried that all of this info at our fingertips is actually making us dumber. But he says, not so fast. Thompson is the author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. And he says the combination of the human brain and technology can be quite powerful. In our interview, he told me how a famous chess match between man and machine set the stage for the two working together.
I got very interested in this question of Deep Blue as kind of a metaphor for what's happening to us. Because, so Garry Kasparov was beaten by Deep Blue, and a lot of people said, well, this is terrible. This is the moment when humans are no longer relevant because machines are better at us than a chess. But what Kasparov did after that was very, very interesting. He said, well, okay, maybe a machine is better at doing this brute force sort of reasoning, you know, like going seven moves out, you see every possible play, and you can beat a human that way. He said, well, rather than compete with the computer, why don't I collaborate with it? And he invented a form of chess called advanced chess, where it would be playing with one team, a person and a computer, versus a person and a computer. So the human could essentially use all the smarts of a computer to play even more complicated chess than they could ever do on their own, you know? And this is exactly what happened. People started playing advanced chess, and they began to produce these chess games that were so fascinating and creative and brilliant that they could never have done on their own. The computer couldn't have done it on their own. The human couldn't have done it on their own. But together, they could do remarkable things. And that's a sort of I regard that as a great metaphor for all the stuff that we're doing online these days.
We'll return to that theme through as we talk now, but there's a sense, there's a lot of messages out there and articles and books even, relying on technology makes us more shallow thinkers. Relying on technology, outsourcing our thinking is making us dumber in the short version. Is that a real common sentiment out there, do you think?
You know, I think I definitely hear it a lot, you know. People tell people, you know that I write about technology, and so they'll ask me, they're like, wow, I'm really worried that I'm getting stupider because I'm not remembering things, or, you know, I'm becoming shallow because I'm writing all these tweets. And I think some of that is innate, you know, sort of, and I think healthy concerns about change. And there's also been an awful lot of sort of very worried op-ed pieces and books lately, you know, things like Nicholas Carr's The Shallows, which worried about the fact that we don't have any time for contemplation, or Sherry Turkle's book Alone Together, which was concerned that, you know, we don't actually spend any time with each other anymore. There's definitely been a sort of a concerned cultural conversation that I think has impacted a lot of people who come up to me with those worries.
You wrote that if we asked you this question 20 years ago, you would have said, yeah, no, this is bad for us. What turned you around in the last couple decades?
Well, it's true. 20 years ago, when I first went online, I was a bit of a nerd, so I was early into this in the early 90s. I thought, I was a bit of a misanthrope too, I think. and I thought, wow, this is terrible. The average person isn't very smart, and they're going to go online and will say stupid things, and it's going to drown out all the intelligent people, and this is bad for society. But what happened is that I'm a reporter, I'm a magazine reporter, so I would be just working. I was interested in this area, and I wanted to know what people would actually do when they had the ability to communicate online, communicate publicly to other people, to talk. And so I was constantly writing stories about, instant messaging came along, and I would talk to people and watch what they were doing with it. And other tools came along, and I kept on discovering that my gloomiest concerns were not really coming true. A little bit, obviously there's a lot of silly things people say online, but I was failing to predict the really amazing things that started happening when people were able to, en masse, think and talk and write in public and with each other. I completely didn't see things like mass collaborations like Wikipedia, or the way that you'd get these hilarious things, people taking, Amazon review threads and hijacking them for political satire, or even the rise of a high level of literacy in photography and video, the way we're now seeing people becoming really elegant communicators in these modes that were never before possible. I didn't see that coming, and so that has made me much more optimistic over time.
One concern I've seen is that in the old days, we relied on our own brains. We couldn't just look something up online, so we had to think it through. We had to have discipline in remembering facts and remembering the things we need to know to get through a day. Now it's at the touch of a button for us, or a click of a mouse, I suppose. Our brains aren't exercising. They're getting flabby because we're not doing this. Do you buy that?
I used to. I used to worry about that deeply because I thought that I discovered that I couldn't really remember any phone numbers anymore. They were all in my phone. And I thought, well, this is a metaphor for the fact that I can't remember anything anymore. But the truth is, when you look at the history of how we have managed our knowledge, it used to be 2,000 or 3,000 years ago before writing became common that it really was all in your head. You had to remember everything. And so when writing came along, Socrates was very upset by this. And in the Phaedrus, which is this terrific dialogue, he said he warned about the arrival of writing. He said that knowledge that's written down will not be in men's souls. It will not be anything we actually know. It won't be true wisdom. And in a way, he was sort of right. Once you write things down, you don't need to memorize them anymore. But he failed to foresee that when you can write things down, when you can store them outside of you, you can consult with a far wider range of ideas and information than ever before possible, and you can have new forms of ideas. And that's what we built libraries for. What's happening now with Google is something in some respects is even weirder. We're using tools like Google or Evernote or our smartphones when we're pinging them for little bits of information. We're actually behaving the way we do with other people. This is called transactive memory. It's the fact that when you're around someone who you know and trust, you start realizing what they're good at remembering, and you sort of don't bother remembering it. You know that they'll know it. And if you're in a long-term relationship with someone, you've probably seen this. I and my wife will be arguing, how come you can't remember where the keys to the car are? And she's yelling at me, how come you can't remember this? Well, it's because each of us knows the other person is in charge of doing that. We trust each other and we're close to each other. And so we're constantly talking to each other for social memory. And social memory is a very, very big deal. It's part of what makes us smarter when we're in groups of people. We're just adapting now to bring in all these devices we have around us into these age-old habits that we've used for centuries to make us smarter.
We had Edward Glaser, author of Triumph of the City, on this network a while back, talking about the benefit of the city is that it brings smart people together to share ideas. Do you see the internet as expanding the city beyond any geographical boundaries and bringing people together and having that kind of collision of ideas?
Yes, I think that's exactly it. the thing about cities is that in one sense they're a real hassle to live in because they're cramped and there's noise and interruptions and you know, we know that on a physiological level it stresses you out. But because we're so close to all those people, there's enormous creativity. You run into people and ideas that you wouldn't know existed. So it's a trade-off. We're willing to endure all the hassles of living in cities because of the creative and cognitive advantages. And it's very similar with what we're experiencing now as life moves online. We're uncomfortable with all of these hassles, the fact that there's something, it can be overwhelming and it can be distracting to be constantly in touch with other people's thoughts. And we're having to learn how to sort of take time to screen those things out. But the upside of being connected to other folks and being able to eavesdrop on what they're thinking about, to throw questions out into the ether and get answers, it's just like being in a city. It ratchets up our creativity and our intelligence. And so we're finding our balance point with that.
Another concern, and you write about it in your book, is that we're interacting with people on a superficial level if we're on social media, say, and it doesn't count. We're just sitting at home. I think you mentioned the Alone Together book earlier. Are we opting out of real important social connections when we just communicate online?
I don't think so, actually. Every piece of evidence I've seen shows that people that are very promiscuous users of communications tools online, like texting, or like instant messaging or whatnot, are also most likely to hang out with their friends face-to-face. Or to put it the other way, they're just very social people. And so when they're doing all that online socializing, it's a supplement to the offline socializing. I think there definitely are, you know, rare limit cases where people substitute online interaction from face-to-face interaction. But by and large, every time anyone has tried to look closely at these correlations, they find that promiscuous online social contact correlates really strongly to hanging out with your friends. And it sort of makes sense when you think about it, because, I mean, I'm sitting here, you know, I occasionally use, you know, something like one of those location-based tools like Foursquare that shows where people are. And, I'll be sitting at home or I'll be out, and every once in a while, it doesn't happen often, but I'll get a ping and I'll notice that someone is actually nearby in my neighborhood and it's someone I haven't seen for a while. And so I'll go, well, I'll text them. Why don't we get together and hang out? This is a wonderful serendipitous discovery. I mean, the fact that you can become more aware of other people has many powerful mechanisms for increasing social contact for people that want it.
That's Clive Thompson, author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. I spoke with him a few months back about the relationship between our brains and our technology. After the break, we'll have the second half of that interview. Right now, here's a few headlines we're keeping an eye on with Kristen Durst from the WPR Newsroom. We're continuing our conversation now with Clive Thompson about the ways technology is changing our minds, he says, in many ways, for the better. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you worry that relying on the internet, going online too much, makes us less smart? Or do you think it's a great tool that that makes us more effective, that helps us think more creatively? Ashley on Facebook writes, I believe that while we may have access to more information to make us possibly more intelligent, the many outlets of technology have put our brains on overload. Our brain no longer has quiet time, no time to process the day's events. What do you think, Clive?
Well, I absolutely agree that it is incredibly important to carve out time and regular time to be away from these connecting devices. Because, I mean, if you sort of grant the force of what I'm arguing here, which is that these new tools allow us to think in interesting new ways, so do the old ones, right? I mean, like, you know, Twitter helps you think conversationally. Sitting down with a book helps you think in a very slow-moving, deep, immersive way. And it's really important to still maintain a lot of those old habits of thought, almost on like a kind of a diversity level, like, you know, like plant, like crop rotation on to keeping a farm fecund. So I've found that a lot of the most astute users of technology have sort of they pick a sort of a Sabbath period almost when they're off every week, you know. And partly inspired by them, I do that myself. I generally stay away from email on the weekends. I also generally not completely, but generally stay away from social media. I don't check that stuff. And it's kind of nice to not be looking at a glowing screen for a long period of time every week. It really does help your brain move in those usefully different patterns. So I think they're absolutely right.
Well, the glowing screen in front of me tells me we have some callers. We'll go to Jason in Madison now. Hi, Jason.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good. What do you think about this?
So not so much social media I wanted to comment on, but just generally the internet. 15 years ago, I had a rare leukemia. There are only 600 cases diagnosed annually in the United States. And I spent countless nights till 2 or 3 in the morning every night till every entry of hairy cell leukemia in Google turned purple, as you know, after you've looked at it. And I found a clinical trial in Washington and a physician that administered it. And I know I never would have found it without the internet. And I'm now cured of the cancer. And it really comes down to the fact that I found this trial online.
Jason, well, I'm glad you found that, and I'm glad you're okay. That's a heck of a story. Clive, I've read about this, people finding medical treatment, also finding support groups and researchers using the internet to pull together people who suffer from rare diseases like Jason's. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I've had some conversations with medical researchers about this, and I think early on, 10 years ago, there was this understandable and legitimate fear that if as patients we went online, and I've certainly done it too, that we would encounter such a trove of stuff that would either befuddle us, or you'd wind up in one of these situations where you're in the discussion group where everyone's sort of peddling quack theories, In reality, what doctors have found is that it's generally been better than that. People turn out to be slightly better consumers of health information than we would have hoped, such that now a lot of doctors tell me. I mean, I had a doctor who told me last year after diagnosis, he handed me the sheet and said, just go Google this and read about it, basically. there's one definitely has to be careful, as I'm sure that gentleman was, that we know what we're looking at. But when your health is on the line, people can often be extremely aggressive, persistent, and critical thinkers.
Thanks a lot for the call, Jason. We've got Corey in Madison with us now. Hi there, Corey.
Hi. Just more of a comment than anything. Earlier you had talked about, the technology, not being a replacement for social interaction or activity, but it also kind of brings people together, for the reasons you mentioned. But I guess my comment is that when I see folks, getting together, they're all just sitting there looking at their phones or their internet appliances, and they're not really interacting or doing anything other than they're in proximity to each other.
Thanks. And that's a common critique, that we're at an event, we're seeing something interesting, and we're looking at our phones. Clive, do you think that's a problem? Is that a concern?
If to the extent that it happens, anytime that happens, that's absolutely a concern. And I think that, like, there's definitely in certain communities and for certain people a sense of reaching a crisis point with that. I mean, that's what I think. Some of that concern is what people have tapped into when they've been worried about this. I think there's a fair amount of evidence from anthropologists and sociologists I talk to who go around and literally look at people's interactions. They say that they think a lot of people are starting to pull back from that over staring at screens moment. This happens frequently. Every time a new technology comes along, we get very excited by it. We get very obsessed with it, and eventually we realize that we're behaving kind of not very well to each other, and we pull back. Mobile phones had this period where in the 90s, when they first came along, if you answered it, no matter when it rang, breakfast, dinner table, in church, in your temple. And then it took about 10 years and a lot of mocking and poking fun at people for doing that. But eventually people stopped doing that, and now you actually rarely see it happen. I think the same curve, accompanied by social censure and mocking, which I think is good, is starting to happen with social media overuse right now. I regard that as actually very healthy to sort of poke fun at people for doing that.
Some people worry about the impact on kids in particular, being too attached to devices, too much screen time, that sort of thing. Is that something that you looked into in the book?
I don't look into it terribly closely, but I have definitely read about it and talked to a lot of pediatricians about it. I mean, by and large, it's a bad idea for kids to spend a huge amount of time staring at screens for all sorts of reasons. There's eye strain. There's the fact that ergonomically your body shouldn't be doing that. And we had the same problem with TV, you know, generations before. I don't think there's anything inherently problematic, though, with a limited and sort of judicious use of screens to do the amazing things that, the internet can do. Because, you know, a lot of teachers have found, for example, that you have real trouble getting kids to write. You know, you need them to practice writing. They don't want to do it. It's boring. They're only writing for their teacher. But if you set up like a class blog and say, okay, we are now writing for the entire world, and other people start coming by and commenting on what the kids have written, you get this unbelievable sense of audience. It's so powerful, and the kids begin writing like mad, you know? So that's an example of using a computer in a way that taps into the amazing connective power that actually produces this really, really good educational outcome. You don't want the kid parked in front of the screen all day long, but there are amazing ways to use them if you use them with a good critical mind.
Jordan is with us now in Black River Falls. Jordan, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
With what was actually just brought up was actually very interesting, but what I had called about was I just got back from studying abroad and I had made tons of friends and I'm a very social person, and social media has been a great outlet for me to keep in touch with my friends that I've made from all across the world. But unlike my brother, who is a little less social than me, I feel like there's also the negative impact where you can kind of use it more as a crutch instead of a tool and kind of live online like that. But which was interesting with what which was just brought up about the blogging. I'm in a social media public relations course, and this past week we were required to get a Twitter and a blog to blog, and we have to do journal entries and things like that. And I feel like I didn't want to adapt into one of those online communities because I feel like that's something that you do get this general audience, and like a group of friends that you would hang out outside of the web socially, you do kind of want to keep up with that audience as well. It does kind of keep you online.
Gotcha. Well, thanks for the call. Talk about that. He's trying to use this as a tool and not, like he says, some people do, as a crutch. Can you wrap
sure.
us up, Clive, by talking about that for a few?
Sure. I mean, I think when people use it really well and not as a crutch, when they use social media to stay in contact with friends, when it's done really well, they get the experience of what's called ambient awareness, which is the fact that if you're able to sort of notice just, you know, at the corner of your eye as you follow their tweets, their pictures, their utterances, all, you know, over a period of weeks and months and years, you can develop this fantastic mental model, this deep intellectual emotional model of what's going on with your friends who you can't see.
That's Clive Thompson, author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. We spoke with him back in September. Coming up after the news, with the inauguration of New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio tomorrow, we'll find out how Democrats came to run the nation's biggest cities, the top 12, I think is the number, and what that can mean for the future of American politics at the local level and across the nation. Hey, as always, we want to know what you think about the show and if you have some ideas for us, too. We're always listening at the Central Time Facebook page. Head over there at Central Time on WPR. Tell us what's on your mind. We're also on Twitter. That's at Central Time WPR. And you can always leave us a good old-fashioned voicemail. Our Central Time hotline is 855-683-5422. That's 855-683-5422. Love to hear your thoughts there. Stick around, there's more to come. I'm Rob Ferret. News is next on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.